Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
Good afternoon. 5 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Glad you're with us for another edition of On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. This week we focus on guardsmen and reservists, and specifically their relationships with their civilian employers. In just the 11 years since September 11th, close to 900,000 of those citizen soldiers have left their civilian lives and served in active duty in the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, and Coast Guard, many of them serving several tours of duty overseas. As of today, even with combat operations winding down, almost 64,000 are still activated. This week, to help us explore the interaction between service in uniform, civilian work, and how employers enable Guard and Reserve service, sometimes extended Guard and Reserve service, we have several guests from the Defense Department office that was created just to handle these issues. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve. And these are not new issues. ESGR was created 40 years ago, just as the Vietnam War and the draft were coming to an end. Later in the show, we're going to get into the rights of service members and the responsibilities of employers under the federal law known as USERRA, and also efforts to get veterans into federal agency workforces. We're going to talk first this hour, though, with one of the people who leads the organization today here at ESGR's headquarters in Alexandria, Virginia. Jim Rebholz is the national chairman of employer support of the Guard and Reserve. And congratulations on the 40th anniversary. Thanks for doing this, sir.
Thank you, Jared. Thanks for having us.
I'd like to start, if we could, with a little bit of history. I mentioned 1972. If you can draw a connection between some of those events I mentioned, the end of the war, the end of the draft, and the need to get employers of guardsmen and reservists.
Certainly. Back in 1972, the war was winding down. And during the war, it was noted that reserves made a very valuable contribution. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that was the onset of the total force policy in the Department of Defense. It also was recognized that the employers were a key factor. So President Nixon signed an executive order creating a public-private partnership, aptly named Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve, and tapped as its first chairman, James M. Roach, who was the retiring chairman of the board of General Motors, at that time the icon of American industry. Mm-hmm. And their whole charter was to develop the concept of reserve service and support by the employers of their men and women who work for them.
And at that point, I think it was just a couple dozen business leaders, right? What did they do? What was their mission?
Actually, it was formed from scratch. Their mission was to encourage employers to abide by formal law set there in World War II, a very embryonic law, but their mission was to create an awareness with employers of the value of the men and women who serve. Remember, that context was in the reserve component, early stages of the Cold War, and at that time, the men and women were serving in a peacetime mode. Right. With drills and training periods in time. And so the goal of the organization when it first started was to allow employers and reserve members to have a common ground of understanding.
And compare that to what you guys do today, if you would. How much has that changed? How much has that not changed?
As you cited earlier, the 11 years we've just gone through has dramatically changed it. We've gone from a Cold War mentality, formerly called a strategic reserve, to a modern concept called the operational reserve, where we rely heavily on our reserve forces. And in fact, approximately 48% of our defense capability is resident in the Guard and Reserve forces, which makes us, by necessity, have an increasing reliance on them, and thus an increasing reliance on employers to support and partner with us with that service.
Mm-hmm. And when we say employer support, what are we talking about?
Okay, what we're talking about employer support is we are talking about a culture within a company that they recognize and reward the service of the men and women they share with us. In the economy today, we're struggling, as the listeners know. Mm-hmm. Well, I told you earlier, 48% of the reserve, 48% of our defense capability is resident in the Guard and Reserve. Mm-hmm. To equal that, obviously, we'd have to have a large, large standing force, which would spiral our deficit way out of control. Right. And so the Guard and Reserve has become an economic component as well as a patriotic component. And so today we are looking for the employers to recognize that as a good business, strategic business move, to allow their men and women to serve when needed, and yet to provide them and their families with the necessary support when they get back. Support ranging not only financial, but also emotional and culturally within the company, within the community.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, at the beginning of the decade, when the wars were just starting up, employers were not used to having employees go off for Guard or Reserve service for months, years at a time. And I can remember very distinctly at the beginning of that period attending press conferences at the U.S. Attorney's Office where I worked at the time, where they were prosecuting employers pretty vigorously because they just didn't understand what they needed to do in order to support their Guard and Reserve employees. How much has that changed in the intervening decade, if it has?
I can tell you it has changed dramatically. I have never seen employer support in this country as strong, as high as it is. The employer recognition of the value of Reserve service is at one of its highest peaks right now. That's a function of our organization, is to educate employers to the various values, to the various rights and responsibilities that they share with their employees.
Mm-hmm. And that's an important point. You guys are not an enforcement agency, correct? You're an education and liaison.
Absolutely not. Our goal is to create a culture. You create a culture not with a stick, but you create a culture with a value. And the value we provide employers is not only education on the expectations of the Reserve components, but also recognizing them for going above and beyond basic requirements and doing things that are way beyond the scope of any legal requirement or any prohibitions or restrictions.
Right. Now, in addition to the leadership that you have from the business community, I understand you have a pretty large cadre of volunteers that are spread out all over the country, too. What do they do? And because that's kind of unusual for any federal agency to have a volunteer workforce.
Well, the key strength of this, and shows the wisdom of our founders, is the public-private partnership. It's realized that you cannot develop a culture in America, the grassroots culture of America, from a central location. And so our organization currently is composed of over 4,800 volunteers who are located in every state and territory of the United States. They're organized in what we call state committees. The value they bring to the table is private sector experience and, most importantly, local community connections, local community relationships, and an understanding of both the military and the civilian requirements of a partnership.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the period at the beginning of these wars. As we're winding down, how do you maintain, or are you going to maintain, the level of support between employers and their employees in the Guard and the Reserve? Because they're not going to be deploying as frequently or for as long, right?
So, well, I can't tell you how frequently they're going to be deployed because that is not in the employer support's business. But basically speaking, the requirements to keep a ready reserve force, to maintain this 48% level of capability, is still going to be a very, very high capability. You've heard various sources in the Pentagon cite different training paradigms, different training needs, et cetera. So our reliance on the Guard and Reserve, I don't see ebbing. You are correct when you talk about the periods of deployment may not be as long, but I'm happy to report that our employer support has gone way beyond patriotism. It has recognized the economics of the Reserve Forces. It's recognized the quality of the Reserve Forces, and that quality is reflected in their employment and the employees that they have. And so I don't see the support ebbing if we do our job in employer support of the Guard and Reserve to continue the education process, to provide predictability to the employers as far as when they can expect to share an employee with us in the government. Mm-hmm. And as long as we continue to keep them informed, communication is everything.
Now, obviously, like any agency, you don't have unlimited resources. So how do you allocate those when you're working with employers? Do you focus on large ones, or are you working in the small business world quite a bit too?
Actually, we're blessed, talking about the government. We have a 4,800 person volunteer force. The volunteer force is unpaid. It matches, it provides an enormous capability for a very budgetary efficient cost.
Right.
So we think we can provide the services that you require, and the increasing provide the services we require, because our level of volunteers is current. And in fact, we develop our networks from the employment ranks. Employers contribute to our volunteer ranks. So we can do that with the limited resources we have. We rely heavily on the volunteers, and that again goes back to the public-private partnership.
And so from an employer's perspective, you know, I was talking earlier about how employers at the beginning of this, I had the sense that they just didn't want to lose employees for months or years at a time. I mean, what's the sales pitch to them that you want to employ or re-employ service members despite that gap in service that they're going to have while they're away serving their country in uniform?
As I said, it maybe is a hard concept to understand, but it's been very gratifying. Employers have not rebelled, as you suggested. In the initial stages of the war, we were all shocked. Frankly, 9/11 was a shock.
Yeah.
But quickly, the employer industrial base of this country came to realize the importance of their employees, because those employees bring a unique contribution to the military. They bring civilian experience. And for years, the military has had some strength resident only in the reserves. The education process that employers are part of the Guard and Reserve for the Future, let's call it ESGR, mm-hmm. what ESGR has brought to the table, it is educated the employers on the need and the possibility. And since 9/11, we have made strides to increase the predictability as to when those people will be mobilized. We give a far enough advance notice, and most importantly, we have also educated our Guard and Reserve members to work with their employers and to try to find times that are mutually agreeable. And so we have not witnessed a great backlash of employers pushing back. If you look at our statistics, which you'll talk about later in the broadcast, you'll see we haven't had a dramatic increase in misunderstandings or inquiries about Guard and Reserve service. So the employer base of this country, I think, realizes that we are all citizens, and they are totally partners in our total force. So we have not had the experiences that you cite of widespread pushback from the employers.
Sure. Last thing before we break, one thing you just mentioned I think is important. I think one thing that is different now than there was at the beginning of the decade is I feel like the reserve components have been working pretty hard to build predictability into these rotations so that you can give employers advance notice of when they can expect to lose these folks for a little while. Is that right?
Absolutely. The Secretary of Defense has stressed the collegiality of the relationship with regards to the employer base of the country and in reserves, and so they have established policies within the department, and the individual services have also established policies that they reach out as far as they can, let employers know, and to work with employers.
Right. One thing that ESGR does and has always done, I think, is to recognize employers who do this well, who support employees who are part of the Guard and Reserve. We're going to talk about that when we come back from a short break. We're talking with Jim Rebholz, the National Chair of Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve. This is on DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbia. We are back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thanks for listening to On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. This week, talking about employer support of the Guard and Reserve. We're talking with Jim Rebholz, the national chairman of that organization, part of DOD, founded 40 years ago. They're just celebrating their 40th anniversary. And want to get into some of the ways that you recognize supportive employers and supervisors within those employers, which is something that I think was one of the original core missions of the agency and that you still do. Let's start with, there's multiple levels of awards that I know you give out to employers to recognize them. Let's start a little bit at the grassroots level, which is the Patriot Awards you give out, right?
It is. And let's just talk about, you asked me earlier in the last segment, how we garner such support. We garner such support because we recognize and deserving employers, and recognition is the surest form of gratification we all can have as individuals. Well, the finest and the best form of recognition is direct from somebody who you have benefited, and that's where the Patriot Award comes in. The Patriot Award is an award given to an employer by his employee. His employee actually nominates the employer and cites what he does to support that employer. And again, I want to emphasize, not necessarily financial support. Mm-hmm. The support of the family also enters into largely with these Patriot Awards. So much so that in the last year or so, we have recognized the sacrifices the spouses and family members make when our reserve guardsmen go to serve. And so we have allowed them to also nominate their employers for what we call a Patriot Award. Mm. And the reason that award is so aptly named is supportive employers are indeed true patriots of the country.
Mm. And so what do they do to earn these awards? Can you give me an example?
Wow, I could give you thousands of examples because those 900,000 members every day are nominating their employers. Yeah. They'll nominate an employer for such things as sending care packages when they are deployed in theater. They will nominate employers for the attention their co-workers have given to their family members. Most importantly, they nominate, and the majority of the Patriot Awards, I must say, are nominating the individual line supervisors, mm-hmm. the direct supervision, the lower levels of the company, who inculcate that culture of support. And again, we use the term support so loosely, who really make it an easier task for the reserve and guardsman to serve his country, both in peacetime and in war.
What else? You mentioned care packages. I mean, and do you guys make suggestions to employers? Here are some of the ways that you really can support?
Yes, we do, because we have core networks of employers, and often our volunteers meet with employers and civic groups like Rotary, like Kiwanis, or whatever, and they share notes, and employers are so willing to share notes with one another because of their strong patriotic things. What we've seen over the years, some of the examples we've seen is obviously care packages that various communities put together, that companies put together. Letter writing, just emails from co-workers, has an invaluable benefit to the person serving alone overseas somewhere or serving distant from his family. Most noteworthy oft times are what they render to the family back home. We have instances where the mail is gone, for instance. Traditional role of cutting the grass, doing the snow shoveling is gone. Co-workers from the company come and shovel the family snow, take the kids to daycare or to Little League baseball. Those sorts of things are grounds we see in the Patriot Awards as reasons why that company is deserving of an award, because it's clearly the culture of that company that enables those co-workers to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned the spouse version of the Patriot Award, fairly new. Are those nominations coming in
fairly new,
high level?
And that was an educational part on our part. Mm-hmm. We're getting so many Patriot Awards from our members that showed that they were citing the support given to the spouses that we suggested, well, maybe the spouse wants to have a say in this as well. Mm-hmm. And it's been received very well. We are seeing an ever-increasing number. That's been about a year and a half, two years old now. And it recognizes the indirect employers, which goes back to what we said earlier in this segment. The employer base of this country is extremely supportive of the guardsmen and reservists, mm-hmm. who they partner with.
And then another award program you have is called the Freedom Award. Explain what that is.
Well, let's go back a step.
Sure.
The Patriot Award is the entry level for all of our award program. We have various levels of awards, mm-hmm. based on the various levels of support. The Patriot Award is the entree. That is the entry point. And from those nominations, we glean both by the sheer number for a particular company or the particular unique characteristic of a person of a particular company, that there's an award called an Above and Beyond Award, where we recognize a company who has started to go above and beyond, and it rises through different levels. The Freedom Award you cite is the highest award the Department of Defense can give to a civilian employer. Mm-hmm. There are a maximum of 15 given in any 1 year. That has evolved, and the reason we're up to 15, and originally when that started in 1996, the Freedom Award program, there was one national winner every year. Mm. Okay, because of the extraordinary support we are getting from employers this year. You just can't pick one anymore. Yeah. It's just overwhelming and gratifying. So now we have a Freedom Award that is awarded to the 15 top employers based on the nominations in the country every year. We have small employers, large employers, and public sector employers. Last year, our nominations were running around 3,600, and the competition is keen, and it's a darn difficult time every year to pick those 15 companies.
Sure. So you mentioned this is not based on size. This is based on what they actually do.
It is based on what they do.
Give me a few examples, if you can, of just extraordinary activities that they've undertaken.
Okay. most of the, let me tell you, all the common denominator of the majority of the employers who won the Freedom Award is they all match pay. They continue pay. They continue benefits when their employers.
So you continue drawing your salary while you're serving.
Many employers will continue to draw the salary, or at least match the salary, the difference in their salary between their civilian job and their military job.
Right.
They provide benefits, particularly health insurance benefits for the family left behind. Obviously, the service members are covered by their individual service health plans. But the pay and benefits are matched. Way above and beyond that are the companies who have dedicated programs and assign mentors, if you will, assign definite sponsors for the employee's family who's left behind. We have had companies go above and beyond when their employees are in a country and they find a lack of medical supplies, a lack of tools or something to do the community building that are necessary. We've had companies ship actually product over there for their employees to distribute free of charge to help their nation building. You'll see the support of employers go into an employee program within the company for the non-Guard and Reserve people to encourage them to interact with their employees. When the employees come back, equally important, they welcome them back with open arms, they publicize, they are proud of their service, and they retrain them if necessary, they make accommodations if necessary, and all return them to the same level and high responsibility jobs that they had before they left. They're genuinely heartwarming stories, and we can tell you, depending on the size of the company, you know, everybody thinks, well, a major corporation can afford to do that. We have companies as small as 3 and 4 employees who do exactly the type of things I just got done telling you about.
For a company that small, that's got to be some degree of financial hardship for them.
It is. There's no denying that. And for that, again, we are grateful for the public-private partnership we have with our employers. It's a financial hardship, which is why they rise to the top. And it's from all segments of the country. And the most important thing I'd like our listeners to know, hopefully they'll recognize some of their employers, is all of these awards are generated by the individual Guardsmen or reservists.
Right.
They are not corporate public affairs driven. They are not Oscar driven. They are not Emmy driven. They are not corporately driven awards. They are the recognition of the company based on his employee.
Right. We've talked about companies so far, but I think probably one of the largest, if not the largest, employer of Guardsmen and Reservists is probably the federal government or the public sector in general. Anybody in the public sector doing things, or do these awards tend to be concentrated in the private sector?
No, as I mentioned, we try to divide the awards between small business, large business, and public sector. And in fact, our public sector award winners are where some of our better stories come from, because first responders are a classic resource that both we need here as civilians as well in the military. So the firemen, the policemen, the police departments have responded greatly. The federal government has responded. The federal government is a model employer, and we're working with them to help that. But the greatest public sector is talking about budget constraints. We all know the public sector operates under budget constraints. For them to share the employees with us as a country is fodder for the awards that are given. And so we have routinely have 5 or more public sector employers every year. They are well represented in the Freedom Award level of awards.
That's great. Talk to me, you got into this a little bit, but tell me a little bit more about why you guys feel like it's important to recognize these employers and what do they get out of it?
We can't quantify what the employer gets out of it, and that's why it's such a rewarding job we do. We feel it's important to recognize the employers, to spread the story, to spread the word, to dispel the myths that maybe go out that we are somehow in a conflict with public and private sector. Mm-hmm. We are not. So the best way to disprove any myths like that or to offset any myths like that is to recognize the accomplishments, the achievements, and the actual actions that employers are taking to share their employees with the men and with the military.
Excellent. Jim Rebholz is the National Chairman of Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve. Thanks so much for talking with us today, sir.
Thanks very much, Jared. Appreciate
it. When we come back, we're going to stay with Guard and Reserve Matters. We're going to talk with an ombudsman here at ESGR about employers' responsibilities and the rights of service members under the federal law known as USERRA. Back in just a minute, this is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is on DOD. I'm Jared Servin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for listening to On DOD. Today, talking about employer support of the Guard and Reserve. We spent the first half of the show, the first couple segments, talking to the national chairman, a little overview of what the agency does. One of the things they do, though, is to increase awareness of what's called the Uniform Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act. Many of our listeners know that as USERRA. It basically outlines the responsibilities of employers with regard to guardsmen and reservists and the rights of service members who are coming back from deployment and in other situations. We're going to talk during this segment with Major Eric Davis. He's an ombudsman with ESGR here at their headquarters and works with employers and with service members to resolve some of the issues that come up under USERRA. And Major Davis, if you can walk us through a little bit of what USERRA actually requires and what rights it gives to service members, that'd be great.
Okay, thank you, Jared. Uniform Services Employment Reemployment Rights Act 1994 is primarily prohibits discrimination in employment based on someone's past service, current service obligations, or interest in service in the uniformed services. In addition, USERRA provides reemployment rights with pre-service employers after qualifying service in the uniformed services. So in general, that person is entitled to be reemployed with the same status, pay, and seniority that they would have attained with reasonable certainty had they remained continuously employed, and that service in the uniformed services is treated as service with the employer for the purposes of seniority and status and those determinations. So USERRA applies to all employers, regardless of size, federal, state government. Even an employer of one is obligated to comply with USERRA.
And so a violation of USERRA might be you return from Guard or Reserve service and your job no longer exists, or you are put back in the position that you would have had, that you had when you left, and you didn't get promotions that you probably were entitled to while you were gone, right?
Potentially. There are always circumstances in which an employer is excused from its compliance obligations under USERRA, but they're narrow and rare. And so what might happen, how it might manifest as a service member is on leave of absence, they return from the job, and as you point out, they return to a job that they had when they left, when in fact they would have likely enjoyed at least two step increases while they were gone. They might have even been eligible for a promotion. The employer is obligated to make up those missed opportunities for the service member.
Mm-hmm. One of the things President Obama did in his 2009 executive order, I think, was tell federal agencies that they needed to set an example in terms of following USERRA. How have agencies done that, and how have you worked with them to help them do that?
It's also the intent of Congress, and right in the act, it talks about the federal government being a model employer. And so since 1994, that's been the clear intent of Congress and the President of the United States. And the federal agencies to do that, I mean, one of the things that we do is the Department of Defense has this defense agency and the Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve Office. And what we're doing is out there to help employers understand their rights and obligations under the law, provide training, and just try to set the example of what it looks like. There's paid military leave for federal employees and government employees at the state level and across the country. These are some of the things that the act does not require, but they're the acts of model employers, people who are going above and beyond to set a standard.
Mm-hmm. And when you see either a company or maybe even a government agency running afoul of USERRA, is it generally because they don't care or they just don't understand what the law requires?
Generally, it's been my experience that they don't understand. It's one of the reasons why our agency and our work as an ombudsman, we have such a success rate. We resolve up to 80% of the cases that come through us in an informal manner. by simply educating both parties on their rights and obligations in the law. Generally speaking, federal agencies and employers of all sizes are absolutely committed to full compliance with the law. They just don't understand necessarily what that entails.
Right. And so what happens in these cases? Does a service member come to you with questions or an actual claim? Talk me through that process of how that works through.
Generally, a service member will learn about our organization and our willingness to assist them. They'll give us a call either on our 800 toll-free number, 1-800-336-4590, or in many cases, and with increasing frequency, they'll find us online at www.esgr.mil. And online, we have an online complaint form, and they can actually fill out, it's not a complaint, but an issues form. Mm-hmm. And they'll fill out and they'll tell us what their experience is, and then one of our trained ombudsmen will get back in touch with them. They generally have a few questions about what they're entitled to or what they can expect under the law. We'll talk them through that. In many cases, those service members, armed with that information, are confident that if they bring that back and they talk with their employers and they that they can resolve the issue themselves. In some cases, they would like some assistance. We have trained ombudsmen who are volunteers throughout the country. These ombudsmen voluntarily take up some time and work with the service member or call the employer and educate them on their rights and obligations under USERRA. And as I said, 80% of the time, that alone is sufficient to resolve it to the satisfaction of both parties.
Mm-hmm. And when a violation comes to you or an inquiry comes to you from a service member, are there common areas that come up over and over again?
I think what we typically see, and this crosses sectors, so this is true of the federal sector, private sector, nonprofit. What we commonly see is the service member will say that or report to us that they are experiencing what they believe to be discrimination. They feel like they're being treated differently because of a service obligation, and they're missing out on opportunities that similarly situated people get to participate in.
Not getting promotions, not getting training.
Precisely. And they attribute that to their service obligations. That's a common issue that we hear and respond to, and the ombudsman are very effective at doing that. Other issues, certainly the reinstatement issue, the service member believes that they were entitled to prompt reinstatement, maybe in a different role or in a different status, and they're concerned that the employer hasn't met all their obligations with regard to their reemployment. We also commonly see and hear questions about things like vacation leave or paid time off and how that works and what they're entitled to use and what their what are their ranges of responsibilities there. The health benefits comes up from time to time. And we also hear a little bit about questions about time limits, both time off before duty and time off to report back to work. So these are some of the things that we typically deal with. And again, with a lot of success, I think.
And then I guess in the serious cases, the enforcement responsibilities are up to the Labor Department and the Justice Department in most cases. But it sounds like you're saying most of these don't get to that point.
I don't know that. The U.S. Department of Labor, you're correct. The Congress has charged them with an enforcement of the law. And so complaints may be heard by the Department of Labor. They could be heard referred to the Department of Justice for follow-up. In the case of the federal government, we may see claims with the Merit Systems Protection Board. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of avenues or remedies that can be sought by service members. And it's I'm not clear as to how many of those cases we interrupt. What I do know is that we worked 2,884 cases in fiscal year 11. If we weren't here to do that, then presumably all 2,884 folks would have filed cases with the Department of Labor. And so I know that we're making an important difference in terms of enforcing the, or not enforcing is the wrong word, educating and helping people comply with the law.
Gotcha. In your civilian life, I know that you're an HR professional with the state of Minnesota, so you have a unique perspective on this. Are the issues between the private sector employers and public sector employers similar or different in terms of the issues that come up most?
I think the issues are the same. They cut across the different sectors of employment. As the HR director for the State Department of Transportation in Minnesota, it's one of my responsibilities to ensure our agency's compliance with USERRA. And so it's a great, great privilege for me. It gives me the perspective of both the employer and the service member as a reservist myself. And I think it helps me be effective in this role. The issues that we see at the Department of Transportation really aren't that different than the issues that a federal agency might see. And it's our commitment, unwavering commitment, to uphold the law and to make sure that the service members who volunteer their time for service in uniform services, that they have a good experience and that they're not worried about their employment with the state of Minnesota when they're serving our country.
I don't know how long you've been serving in this role, but have you noticed a change in just general awareness and compliance out there in either the public sector or the private sector or both over time?
I have. I had the privilege actually being a part of this organization shortly after the attacks of September 11th in 2001. And the calls that we were getting at that time from employers, they were inspiring. We actually pulled our call center together, anticipating a lot of questions. And so we staffed that call center for 24 hours for a while. And the people were calling and they said, we want to be one of America's best employers, service members. And can you tell us what that looks like? And what are some of the things that we need to be aware of? That proactive response on the part of America's employers was inspiring to me. And I see the level of awareness going up. I think ESGR has played a big role in that. But certainly there organizations like the Society of Human Resource Management and the IPMA in the federal side or the public side have done so much to educate employers across the country about their obligations under USERRA. So I think the knowledge is out there.
Gotcha. Major Eric Davis is an ombudsman with Employer Support for the Garden Reserve. We're spending the hour talking about the Garden Reserve and their interaction with their civilian employers. Thanks so much for talking with us about USERRA, Major.
Thank you, Jerry.
When we come back, we're going to talk about employment programs and addressing the high unemployment rate among guardsmen and reservists coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. This is on DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. We are back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jared Serbu, talking this week about employer support of the Guard and Reserve, a DOD agency that does basically what the name says. We've spent a lot of time talking about USERRA, the federal law that outlines the responsibilities of employers and the rights of employees who happen to be guardsmen and reservists, and what the agency's done over the past 40 years. Going to spend this last segment talking about employment and reemployment of guardsmen and reservists coming back into their civilian employment, in many cases without civilian employment. And our guests for this segment are going to be ESGR's director, Mr. Ron Young, and Sergeant Major Wayne Bowser, who's the Senior Enlisted Advisor for Family and Employer Programs and Policy. And first of all, thanks both for doing this. And Mr. Young, if you can talk to me about sort of the scale of the problem that you guys are trying to tackle in terms of unemployment.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having us here this morning. The unemployment issue within the reserve component is a big issue. The veteran population across the country, the statistics say 7 to 8% are unemployed. But in a reserve component, our general population is about 13%. And in our junior enlisted personnel, our E1s to E4s, our 18 to 24-year-olds, that rate exceeds 24%.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that based on a recent Status of Forces survey that went out to about 121,000 of our members.
And how does that happen for that younger age group? Were most of them not employed when they entered Guard or Reserve service, or did they lost their employment somehow during the course of serving? How does that happen?
Oh, I think it's a multitude of things. I think a lot of our junior enlist right out of high school,
mm-hmm.
haven't been to college yet. The economy since 2008 has had a huge impact, no doubt. So some of these individuals, the vast majority that come back from deployments unemployed, probably left unemployed, mm-hmm. quite honestly. But the economy has had an effect on some companies that have closed because of that. And so there have been a number of reservists come home from deployments that their company no longer existed. So because of the significance of the number, January of 2011, Reserve Affairs over in DOD embarked on this employment initiative program across the country because we have ESGR committees in every state. And we ask our volunteers out there, as they engage with employers, as they're out there signing statements of support with employers, that they also ask them, are you doing any hiring?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you are, we've got a great workforce here in our reserve component people mm-hmm. coming home.
Now, I know it's a government-wide priority to employ returning veterans. Does ESGR have a piece of that? And tell me about that piece of that, how it interacts in the whole puzzle of what the federal government's trying to do.
Well, we do have a piece, and that piece comes apart because of the Yellow Ribbon Reintegration Program. That's a congressionally mandated program, and part of that program was mandated by Congress that we provide returning service members employment assistance when they come home. I've always said that how can you reintegrate into your civilian life if you don't have a job? So when our service members come home, they demobilize at the demobilization station, they come back to their hometown armory. If you don't have a job, then it can lead to lots of other bad things like homelessness or other things. So we took it on as a mission. The reserve component chiefs have all taken it on as a mission, and we're working it very hard. That's why we developed Hero to Hard, H2H.
It strikes me that perhaps the active component has a little bit of an advantage that the reserve component doesn't, because when they come back, they're often coming back into large military communities that where some of this infrastructure, the support infrastructure exists. Not always true for guardsmen and reservists, right?
Well, that's true. Our folks come home, and they come home to 3,500 communities across the country. And the reason Congress mandated in 2008 this Yellow Ribbon Reintegration Program was specifically for the reserve component, because they do not have that installation to come back to. And so this program requires that the services at a 30, 60, and 90-day period after the service member comes home, that they have specific requirements to attend classes, to be provided services and support, for the community to embrace them and help them reintegrate into their civilian lifestyle.
And one of the programs that you operate is called the Mobile Job Store. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
The Mobile Job Store is just one component of Hero to Hard. It's a 26-foot expandable van. Command Sergeant Major Bowser is taking it all around the country because of the reserve component being geographically so separated. We're taking the job opportunities to them. He can tell you about his experiences over the past 6 months of doing just that.
Yeah, Sergeant Major, please tell me a little bit about those interactions with service members that you've had.
Exactly. Thank you, I will. Most of the interactions that we've had with individuals when we bring the Mobile Job Store into the locations is that they see it, and first of all, they think it's a wonderful thing. But once they get inside the Mobile Job Store, we're helping service members actually connect directly to employers within their areas. I'll say within a 100-mile radius, and we can break that down to 25 miles as well. Some service members would like to go ahead and relocate as well, so they're able to do that by way of going under this massive job site engine within the Mobile Job Store itself.
I don't know if you can characterize it this way, but are these employers who have sort of a national presence that are in communities all across the country, or are you actually going out on the ground and finding maybe even small businesses who operate in that local community before you go out with the Mobile Job Store?
That's a very good question. Yes, that's what our employer of support of the Guard and Reserve does, ESGR individuals. There's over 4,800 of these individuals that are out voluntarily working, and they're going in, as Mr. Young mentioned earlier, to each and every one of these small businesses and talking with individuals and then asking them, will they support our Guard and Reserve as well as their spouses? So it's a wonderful tool that they do, and we interact with them constantly.
And describe that experience of interacting with the service members out there. How often are you able to find them employment when they come back?
Oh, that's a very good question as well. Right now, the numbers overall I do not have of how many individuals actually found jobs through H2H.jobs overall, but the interaction with them is dynamite. What happens is when the individuals come in and we get a chance to talk with them, we find different circumstances for every individual service member and their spouses. I'm reminded of a story of a young lady that came into Brookings, Oregon. We were out doing a mobile job store site there, and she came in and did not have much at all that she was bringing into the family. Her husband could not work due to some type of medical issues, and so therefore, we went on the site, found her some positions in the area, and it was doing vastly much more in salary than what she was already bringing in. So she went out, and she's actually seeking jobs through individuals right now from the help of the mobile job store.
Could I add some? Just share an experience I had at Great Falls, Montana. We did a Hero to Hire job fair in partnership with the National Chamber of Commerce. They're hiring our Heroes program at Great Falls. And I played undercover boss that day. I didn't want anybody to know that I was coming. In fact, I'd been on vacation at the National Park out there, and I was just getting ready to fly home. As I came into that job fair, it was jam-packed, and I pulled up to the security guard, and I said, "Hey, what's going on?" He said, "Well, they're having a big job fair, lots of people here." And I said, "Where can I park?" He said, "Oh, down the street." So I parked down the street, even though they had me a reserved 3-star slot there. And I walked down, and as I'm coming across, this gentleman's walking across, and I said, "Hey, what's going on?" He said, "Oh, man, they're having a great job fair in there." I said, "Really? Who is it?" And he told me it's ESGR and the National Chamber and all this. And I said, "Well, what happened?" He said, "I got a job today." I said, "Well, tell me a little bit about you." He said, "I'm a West Point graduate." I said, "What?" He said, "I'm a West Point graduate." And he pulled the sleeve of his arm up, and he had a titanium wrist, and his fingers were titanium. And he said, "I'm a disabled veteran that I had to be discharged because an IED blew up. And my wife loved the military life so much, she joined the Air Force. And our first assignment is here at the Great Falls, Montana Air Base. I'm a spouse now accompanying my wife, who's a service member, and I'm an IT specialist, West Point graduate, and I've been having trouble finding a job for 2 months. I came to this job fair this morning, and I got a job from a new company that's moving to Great Falls." And he said, "So, sir, you need to get over there and get in there." That's what he told me. And I never told him who I was or nothing, but that told me what we're doing is right.
That's an incredible story. As far as ingesting employers into this program, do they come to you because they specifically want ex-military or currently serving reservists and guardsmen?
Sir, they do. And one of the things we found, you know, I talked about our statement of support program. Over the past 3 years, we've signed over 158,000 statements of support across the country with employers. And these employers make a commitment that they will abide by USERRA, that they believe in hiring service members because of the 10 reasons to hire them, everything that a service member brings to the workplace, and they will talk about it. So we have employers out there that have jobs. Their problem is trying to find this supply. And so what H2H does is bridge that gap. We get the employers to put their jobs on the website, and we get the service members to put their resumes in there and to develop their career interests. One thing the sergeant major does is he works them through a 14-question assessment, so if they don't know what they want to do, that this assessment will give them ideas, well, this career would be good for you. Isn't that right?
That's exactly right, sir. And through the 14-question career assessment test, it's something that's strictly for them to see on their own while they're in the system. Once they sign up and actually take the career assessment, what they wind up doing is finding great jobs within the area that actually will hire them for their likes and dislikes as well. Even though they don't know exactly what they wanted to do when they came into the mobile job store, as well as probably did not want to continue doing the same thing that they did that they were in the military for over X amount of years.
Mm. I want to expand on that last question a little bit if I can. You mentioned that employers are looking for a supply. Is there a unique supply in the Guard and Reserve that they're not able to find in the general population? Is that what you were getting at?
What they told us, I went to the Clinton Global Initiative in Chicago last year. And there were a lot of employers there making commitments that they want to hire service members. Mm-hmm. And as I listened to them, and they tell us they want to hire them because, you know, these service members bring leadership skills. They bring responsibility. They bring ethics. They bring to the workplace a drug-free environment. they were just having trouble about where do I find them? How do I get access to them? Because employers, per se, can't come into the hometown armory on the weekend because we've got training responsibilities to keep them ready. So we're helping to bridge that gap, to link the two together so that both parties can get a win-win out of this.
Last thing, especially in that younger age group, I'm imagining that one of the things they need in addition to employment is education and training opportunities. Are you guys involved in that as well?
We are, sir. We help make sure that they are aware of the, through the Yellow Ribbon Reintegration Program, all the VA benefits. We enroll them with VA when they've come back and they qualify for that status. Mm-hmm. But there's also a big part of our force out there in a reserve component that don't meet the statutory definition of a veteran, meaning they haven't served the 179 days on active duty to get that status. So we need to accommodate that part of the force too and help them get jobs. And it's going pretty well, quite honestly.
If I might add to that as well, within the H2H.jobs site that we have, there's also areas where we help them with resumes, also with another tool of interviewing, helping them understand the interview process and the skills that they need to be able to meet that civilian population as well. So it's a lot of things within the site that we do to help them along the way with that.
What employers and human resource managers have told us is we have trouble understanding the military jargon that service members speak sometimes. So we have a great tool in H2H that helps interpret those military skill sets to civilian skill sets. Mm. And we work with an organization called SHRM, the Society of Human Resource Managers. They also help us with all their chapters around the country to help civilianize this military career so that employers can hire you.
Excellent. Last thing before we go, we should let employers know how they get in touch with you guys if they're interested in participating in these programs.
Well, they can go to our H2H.jobs website. ESGR also has a 1-800 telephone number, 1-800-336-4590. In every one of the states across the country, we have a state committee with a state chairman and a volunteer force there that would come and love to come and talk to them about any of these programs.
And this one particular program, again, as the boss mentioned, is H2H.jobs, not .com, H2H.jobs, so we can help you find that next career.
Excellent. Sergeant Major Wayne Bowser is the Senior Enlisted Advisor for Family and Employer Programs and Policy, that last voice you had just heard there. Also been talking with Ron Young, the Director of Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve. Thanks for listening to On DoD on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this show, you can visit us online at federalnewsradio.com. You'll also find all of our past shows there. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for listening. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.